Zaxby's just out-Philly the Philly again. The Zaxby's Chicken Philly is back with garlic aioli, sautéed peppers and onions, decadent melty cheese, and your choice of Zaxby's signature crispy chicken fingers or delicious grilled chicken. But it's only back for a limited time, so enjoy it while you can. No pressure. It's just the greatest sandwich of all time on a ticking clock. Order the Chicken Philly today. Who's got the sauce? Zaxby's.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Chapter 18 of At the Time Appointed. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Lars Rolander. At the Time Appointed by A. Maynard Barbour. Chapter 18. On the Divide. Summer had merged into autumn. Crisp, exhilarating mornings ushered in glorious days flooded with sunshine, followed by sparkling, frosty nights. The strike at the mining camp had been adjusted. The union boarding house, after 2 months, was found a failure and abandoned, and the strikers gradually returned to their work. Mr. Underwood, during the shutdown, had improved the time to enlarge the mill and add considerable new machinery. This work was now nearly completed. In 2 weeks the mill would again be running, and he offered Darrell his old position as assayer in charge, which the latter, somewhat to Mr. Underwood's surprise, accepted. Although his city business was now quite well established, Darrell felt that life at the Pines was becoming unendurable. Walcott's visits were now so frequent, it was impossible longer to avoid him. The latter's air of easy self-assurance, the terms of endearment which fell so flippantly from his lips, and his bold, passionate glances, which never failed to bring the rich, warm blood to Kate's cheeks and brow, all, to one possessing Darrell's fine, chivalric nature and his delicacy of feeling, were intolerable. In addition, the growing indications of Kate's unhappiness, the silent appeal in her eyes, the pathetic curves forming about her mouth, and the touch of pathos in the voice, whose every tone was music to his ear, seemed at times more than he could bear. There were hours, silent, brooding hours of the night, when he was sorely tempted to defy past and future alike, and, despite the conditions surrounding himself, to rescue her from a life which could have in store for her nothing but bitterness and sorrow. But with the dawn his better judgment returned. Conscience, inexorable as ever, still held sway. He kept his own counsel as in duty bound, going his way with a heart that grew heavier day by day, and was hence glad of an opportunity to return once more to the seclusion of the mountains. Kate, realizing that all further appeal to her father was useless, as a last resort trusted to Walcott's sense of honor, that, when he should fully understand her feelings towards himself, he would discontinue his attentions. But in this she found herself mistaken. Taking advantage of the courtesy which she extended to him in accordance with the promise given her father, he pressed his suit more ardently than ever. "Why do you persist in annoying me in this manner?" she demanded one day, indignantly withdrawing from his attempted caresses.
The fact that my father has given you his permission to pay attention to me does not warrant any such familiarity on your part."
"Perhaps not," Walcott replied in his low, musical tones, "but stolen waters are often sweetest. If I have offended, pardon. I supposed my love for you would justify me in offering any expression of it. But since you say I have no right to do so, I beg of you, my dear Miss Underwood, to give me that right."
"That is impossible," Kate answered firmly.
"Why impossible?" he asked.
"Because I will not accept any expressions of a love that I cannot reciprocate."
"Love begets love," he argued softly. "So long as you keep me at arm's length, you have no means of knowing whether or not you could reciprocate my affection. Mr. Underwood has done me the great honor to consent to bestow his daughter's hand upon me, and I have no doubt of yet winning the consent of the lady herself, if she will but give me a fair chance."
"Mr. Walcott," said Kate, her eyes ablaze with indignation, "would you make a woman your wife who did not love you, who never could under any circumstances love you?"
Walcott suddenly seized her hands in his, looking down into her eyes with his steady, dominant gaze. "If I loved her as I love you," he said slowly, "I would make her my wife though she hated me, and win her love afterwards. I can win it, and I will."
"Never!"
Kate exclaimed passionately, but he had kissed her hands and was gone before she could recover herself. In that look she had for the first time comprehended something of the man's real nature, of the powerful brute force concealed beneath the smooth, smiling exterior. Her heart seemed seized and held in a vice-like grip, while a cold, benumbing despair settled upon her like an incubus, which she was unable to throw off for days. It lacked only 2 days of the time set for Darrell's return to the mining camp, when he and Kate set out one afternoon, accompanied by Duke, for a ride up the familiar canyon road. At first their ponies cantered briskly, but as the road grew more rough and steep, they were finally content to walk quietly side by side. For a while neither Darrell nor Kate had much to say. Their hearts were too oppressed for words. Each realized that this little jaunt into the mountains was their last together, that it constituted a sort of farewell to their happy life of the past summer and to each other. Each was thinking of their first meeting under the pines on that evening, gorgeous with the sunset rays and sweet with the breath of June roses. At last they turned into a trail which soon grew so steep and narrow that they dismounted, and, fastening their ponies, proceeded up the trail on foot. Slowly they wended their way upward, pausing at length on a broad, projecting ledge a little below the summit, where they seated themselves on the rocks to rest a while. Kate's eyes wandered afar over the wonderful scene before them, wrapped in unbroken silence, yet palpitating in the mellow, golden sunlight with a mysterious life and beauty all its own. But Darrell was for once oblivious to the scene. His eyes were fastened on Kate's face, a look in them of insatiable hunger, as though he were storing up the memory of every line and lineament against the barren days to come. He wondered if the silent, calm-faced, self-contained woman beside him could be the laughing, joyous maiden whom he had seen flitting among the trees and fountains at their first meeting, little more than 3 months past. He recalled how he had then thought her unlike either her father or her aunt, and believed her to be wholly without their self-restraint and self-repression. Now he saw that the same stoical blood was in her veins. Already the sensitive, mobile face, which had mirrored every emotion of the impulsive, sympathetic soul within, bore something of the impassive calm of the rocks surrounding them.
It might have been chiseled in marble, so devoid was it at that moment of any trace of feeling. A faint sigh seemed to break the spell, and she turned facing him with her old-time sunny smile. "What a regal day!" she exclaimed.
"It is," he replied. "It was on such a day as this, about a year ago, that I first met Mr. Britton. He called it, I remember, one of the coronation days of the year. I have been reminded of the phrase and of him all day."
"Dear Mr. Britton," said Kate, "I have not seen him for more than 2 years. He has always been like a second father to me. He used to have me call him Papa when I was little, and I've always loved him next to Papa. You and he correspond, do you not?"
"Yes, he writes rather irregularly, but his letters are precious to me. He was the first to make me feel that this cramped, fettered life of mine held any good or anything worth living for. He made me ashamed of my selfish sorrow, and every message from him, no matter how brief, seems like an inspiration to something higher and nobler."
"He makes us all conscious of our selfishness," Kate answered. "For if ever there was an unselfish life, a life devoted to the alleviation of the sufferings and sorrows of others, it is his. I wish he were here now," she added with a sigh. "He has more influence with Papa than all the rest of us combined, though perhaps nothing even he might say would be availing in this instance."
In all their friendly intercourse of the last few weeks there had been one subject tacitly avoided by each, to which, although present in the mind of each, no reference was ever made. From Kate's last words Darrell knew that subject must now be met. He must know from her own lips the worst. He turned sick with dread and remained silent. A moment later Kate again faced him with a smile, but her eyes glistened with unshed tears.
"Poor Papa," she said softly, her lips quivering. "He thinks he is doing it all for my happiness, and no matter what wretchedness or misery I suffer, no knowledge of it shall ever pain his dear old heart."
"Katie, must it be?" Darrell exclaimed, each word vibrating with anguish. "Is there no hope, no chance of escape for you from such a fate?"
"I cannot see the slightest reason to hope for escape," she replied with the calmness born of despair. She clasped her small hands tightly and turned a pale, determined face towards Darrell.
"You know, you understand it all, and I know that you do," she said, "so there is no use in our avoiding this any longer. I want to talk it over with you and tell you all the truth, so you will not think by and by that I have been false or fickle or weak, but first there is something I want you to tell me." She paused a moment, then looking him full in the eyes, she asked earnestly,
"John Darrell, do you still love me?"
Startled out of his customary self-control, Darrell suddenly clasped her in his arms, exclaiming,
"Katie, darling, how can you ask such a question? Do you think my love for you could ever grow less?"
For a moment her head nestled against his breast, with a little movement of ineffable content, as she replied,
"No, it was not that I doubted your love, but I wanted an assurance of it to carry with me through the coming days."
Then, gently withdrawing herself from his embrace, she continued in the same calm, even tones,
"You ask if there is no chance of escape. I can see absolutely none, but I want you to understand, if I am forced into this marriage which Papa has planned for me, that it is not through any weakness or cowardice on my part, that if I yield, it will be simply because of the love and reverence I bear my father."
Though her face was slightly averted, Darrell could see the teardrops falling, but after a slight pause she proceeded as calmly as before.
In all these years he has tried to be both father and mother to me, and even in this he thinks he is acting for my good. I have never disobeyed him, and were I to do so now, I believe it would break his heart. I am all that he has left, and after what he has suffered in his silent Spartan way, I must bring joy, not sorrow, to his declining years, and this will be my only reason for yielding."
"But, Kate, dear child," Darrell interposed, "have you considered what such a life means to you? What is involved in such a sacrifice?"
She met his troubled gaze with a smile. "Yes, I know," she replied. "There is not a phase of this affair which I have not considered. I am years older than when we met 3 months ago, and I have thought of everything that a woman can think of."
She watched him a moment, the smile on her lips deepening.
"Have you considered this?" she asked. "Only those whom we love have the power to wound us deeply. One whom I do not love will have little power to hurt me. He can never reach my heart. That will be safe in your keeping."
Darrell bowed his head upon his hands with a low moan. Kate, laying her hand lightly upon his shoulder, continued,
"What I particularly wanted you to know before our parting and to remember is this: that come what may, I shall never be false to my love for you. No matter what the future may bring to you or to me, my heart will be yours."
Darrell raised his head, his face tense and rigid with emotion. She had risen and was standing beside him.
"I can never forgive myself for having won your heart, Katie," he said gravely. "It is the most precious gift that I could ask or you could bestow, but one to which I have no right."
"Then hold it in trust," she said softly, "until such time as I have the right to bestow it upon you, and you have the right to accept it."
Startled not only by her words, but by the gravity of her tone and manner, Darrell glanced swiftly towards Kate, but she had turned and was slowly climbing the mountain path. Springing to his feet, he was quickly at her side. Drawing her arm within his own, he assisted her up the rocky trail, scanning her face as he did so for some clue to the words she had just spoken. But excepting a faint flush, which deepened under his scrutiny, she gave no sign, and the trail for the next half hour being too difficult to admit of conversation, they made the ascent in silence. On reaching the summit, an involuntary exclamation burst from Darrell at the grandeur of the scene. Northwest and south, far as the eye could reach, stretched the vast mountain ranges unbroken, with here and there gigantic peaks, snow-crowned, standing in bold relief against the sky, while far to the eastward lay the valleys, threaded with silver streams, and beyond them in the purple distance outlines of other ranges, scarcely distinguishable from the clouds against which they seemed to rest. Kate watched Darrell, silently enjoying his surprise.
"This is my favorite resort, on the summit of the Divide," she said. "I thought you would appreciate it. It involves hard climbing, but it is worth the effort."
"Worth the effort, yes, 1,000 times. What must it be to see the sunrise here?"
Lifted out of themselves, they wandered over the rocks, picking the late flowers which still lingered in the crevices, watching the shifting beauty of the scene from various points, for a time forgetful of their trouble, till, looking in each other's eyes, they read the final farewell underlying all, and the old pain returned with tenfold intensity. Seating themselves on the highest point accessible, they talked of the future, ignoring so far as possible the one dreaded subject, speaking of Darrell's life in the mining camp, of his studies, and of what he hoped to accomplish, and of certain plans of her own. Duke, after an extended tour among the rocks, came and lay at their feet, watching their faces with anxious solicitude,
quick to read their unspoken sorrow, though unable to divine its cause. At last the little that could be said had been spoken. They paused, their hearts oppressed with the burden of what remained unsaid, which no words could express. Duke, perplexed by the long silence, rose and, coming to Kate's side, stood looking into her eyes with mute inquiry. As Kate caressed the noble head, she turned suddenly to Darrell.
"John, would you like to have Duke with you? Will you take him as a parting gift from me?"
"I would like to have him above anything you could give me, Katie," he replied, "but you must not think of giving him up to me."
"I will have to give him up," she said simply. "Papa dislikes him already. He is so unfriendly to Mr. Walcott, and he himself absolutely hates Duke. I believe he would kill him if he dared. So you understand I could not keep him much longer. He will be happy with you, for he loves you, and I will be happy in remembering that you have him."
"In that case," said Darrell, "I shall be only too glad to take him, and you can rest assured I will never part with him." The sinking sun warned them that it was time to return, and after one farewell look about them, they prepared to descend. As they picked their way back to the trail, they came upon two tiny streams flowing from some secret spring above them. Side by side, separated by only a few inches, they rippled over their rocky bed, murmuring to each other in tones so low that only an attentive ear could catch them, sparkling in the sunlight as though for very joy. Suddenly, near the edge of the narrow plateau over which they ran, they turned and, with a tinkling splash of farewell, plunged in opposite directions, the one eastward, hastening on its way to the great Father of Waters, the other westward bound towards the land of the setting sun. Silently Kate and Darrell watched them. As their eyes met, his face had grown white, but Kate smiled, though the tears trembled on the golden lashes. "A fit emblem of our loves, Katie," Darrell said sadly.
"Yes," she replied, but her clear voice had a ring of triumph. "A fit emblem, dear, for though parted now, they will meet in the commingling of the oceans, just as by and by our loves will mingle in the great ocean of love. I can imagine how those two little streams will go on their way, as we must go, each joining in the labor and song of the rivers as they meet them, but each preserving its own individuality until they find one another in the ocean currents, as we shall find one another some day."
"Katie," said Darrell earnestly, drawing nearer to her, "have you such a hope as that?"
"It is more than hope," she answered. "It is assurance, an assurance that came to me, I know not whence or how, out of the darkness of despair."
They had reached the trail, and here Kate paused for a moment. It was a picture for an artist, the pair standing on that solitary height, the young girl fair and slender as the wild flowers clinging to the rocks at their feet, yet with a poise of conscious strength, the man at her side, broad-shouldered, deep-chested, strong-limbed, his face dark with despair, hers lighted with hope. Suddenly a small white hand swept the horizon with a swift undulatory motion that reminded Darrell of the flight of some white-winged bird, and Katie cried,
"Did we think of the roughness and steepness of the path below when we stood here 2 hours ago and looked on the glory of this scene? Did we stop to think of the bruises and scratches of the ascent, of how many times we had stumbled, or of the weariness of the way? No, it was all forgotten. And so when we come to stand together, by and by, upon the heights of love, such love as we have not even dreamt of yet, will we then look back upon the tears, the pain, the heartache of today? Will we stop to recount the sorrows through which we climbed to the shining heights? No, They will be forgotten in the excess of joy."
Darrell gazed at Kate in astonishment. Her head was uncovered, and the rays of the sinking sun touched with gleams of gold the curling locks which the breeze had blown about her face, till they seemed like a golden halo. She had the look of one who sees within the veil which covers mortal faces. She seemed at that moment something apart from earth. Taking her hand in his, he asked brokenly, "Sweetheart, will that day ever come, and when?" Her eyes, luminous with love and hope, rested tenderly upon his shadowed face as she replied, "At the time appointed, and that will be God's own good time for you and me." End of chapter 18. Read by Lars Rolander. Chapter 19 of At the Time Appointed. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Lars Rolander. At the Time Appointed by A. Maynard Barbour. Chapter 19. The Return to Camp Bird. The day preceding Darrell's departure found him busily engaged in breaking camp, as he termed it. The assayer's outfit which he had brought from the mill was to be packed, as were also his books and quantities of carefully written notes, the results of his explorations and experiments, to be embodied later in the work which he had in preparation, were to be sorted and filed. Late in the afternoon, Kate and her aunt, downtown on a shopping tour, looked in upon him. "Buried up to his ears," Kate announced at the door as she caught a glimpse of Darrell's head over a table piled high with books and manuscripts. "It's well we came when we did, Auntie. A few minutes later and he would have been invisible." "Don't take the trouble to look for seats, Mr. Darrell," she added, her eyes dancing with mischief, as he hastily emerged and began a futile search for vacant chairs. "We only dropped in for a minute, and standing room only will be sufficient."
"Yes, don't let us hinder you, Mr. Darrell," said Mrs. Dean. "We just came in to see how you were getting on, and to tell you not to trouble yourself about the things from the house. We will send and get them whenever we want them."
"I was thinking of those a while ago," Darrell answered, glancing at the pictures and hangings which had not yet been removed. "I was wondering if I ought not to send them up to the house."
"No," said Mrs. Dean, "we do not need them there at present, and any time we should want them we can send Bennett down after them."
"We will not send for them at all, Auntie," said Kate in her impulsive way. "I shall keep the room looking as much as possible as when Mr. Darrell had it, and I shall use it as a waiting-room whenever I have to wait for Papa. It would be much pleasanter than waiting in that dusty, musty old office of his."
"My room at the camp will look very bare and plain now," said Darrell, "after all the luxuries with which you have surrounded me, though I will, of course, get accustomed to it in a few days." Kate and her aunt slyly exchanged smiles, which Darrell in his momentary abstraction failed to observe. They chatted pleasantly for a few moments, but underneath the light words and manner was a sadness that could not be disguised, and it was with a still heavier heart that Darrell returned to his work after Kate and her aunt had gone. At last all was done. The last package was stowed away in the large wagon which was to carry the goods to camp, and the team moved up the street in the direction of the pines, where it was to remain overnight, ready for an early start the next morning. Darrell, after a farewell survey of the little room, followed on foot, heartsick and weary, going directly to the stables to see the wagon safely stored for the night. He was surprised to see a second wagon loaded with furniture, rugs, and pictures, all of which looked strangely familiar, and which on closer inspection he recognized
as belonging to the room which he had always occupied at the Pines. He turned to Bennett, who was standing at a little distance, ostensibly cleaning some harness, but quietly enjoying the scene. "Bennett, what does this mean?" he inquired. "Where are these goods going?"
"To the camp, sir."
"Surely not to the mining camp, Bennett. You must be mistaken."
"No mistake about it, sir. They goes to Camp Bird tomorrow morning. Them's Mrs. Dean's orders."
Darrell was more touched than he cared to betray. He went at once to the house, and in the hall, dim with the early twilight, was met by Mrs. Dean herself.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Darrell," she began, "but you can't occupy your room tonight. You'll have to take the one adjoining on the south. Your room was torn up today, and we haven't got it put to rights yet."
"Mrs. Dean," Darrell answered, his voice slightly unsteady, "you are too kind. It breaks a fellow all up and makes this sort of thing the harder." Mrs. Dean turned on the light as though for a better understanding.
"I don't see any special kindness in turning you out of your room on your last night here," she remarked quietly, "but we couldn't get it settled."
Darrell could not restrain a smile as he replied, "I'm afraid it will be some time before it is settled with the furniture packed out there in the stables."
"Have you been to the stables?" she exclaimed in dismay.
A smile was sufficient answer.
"If that isn't too bad," she continued, "I was going to have that wagon sent ahead in the morning, before you were up, and have it for a surprise when you got there. And now it's all spoiled. I declare I'm too disappointed to say a word."
"But, Mrs. Dean," Darrell interposed hastily as she turned to leave,
"you need not feel like that. The surprise was just as genuine and as pleasant as though it had been as you intended. Besides, I can thank you now, whereas I couldn't then."
"That's just what I didn't want and don't want now," she answered quickly.
"If there's anything I can do for you, God knows I'll do it the same as though you were my own son, and I want no thanks for it either."
And with these words she left the room before Darrell could reply. Everything that could be done to make the rooms look cheerful and homelike as possible had been done for that night. The dining-room was decorated with flowers, and when, after dinner, the family adjourned to the sitting-room, a fire was burning in the grate, and around it had been drawn the most comfortable seats in the room. But to Darrell the extra touches of brightness and beauty seemed only to emphasize the fact that this was the last night of anything like home life that he would know for some time to come. It had been agreed that he and Kate were to have some music that evening, and on the piano he saw the violin, which he had not used since the summer's happy days. He lifted it with the tender, caressing manner with which he always handled it, as though it were something living and human. Turning it lovingly in his hands, he caught the gleam of something in the firelight, and bending over it, saw a richly engraved gold plate, on which he read the words, "To John Darrell, a souvenir of the Pines, from Katie." A mist rose before his eyes. He could not see. He could not trust himself to speak, but raising the violin, his pent-up feelings burst forth in a flood of liquid music of such commingled sweetness and sadness as to hold his listeners entranced. Mr. Underwood, for once forgetful of his pipe, looked into the fire with a troubled gaze. He understood little of the power of expression, but even he comprehended dimly the sorrow that surged and ebbed in those wild harmonies. Mrs. Dean, her hands folded idly above her work, sat with eyes closed, a solitary tear occasionally rolling down her cheek, while in the shadows Kate, her face buried on Duke's head and neck, was sobbing quietly. Gradually the wild strain subsided, as the summer tempest dies away till nothing is heard but the patter of the raindrops. and after a few bars from a love song, a favorite of Kate's, the music glided into the simple strains of Home, Sweet Home, and as the oppressed and overheated atmosphere is cleared by the brief storm, so the overwrought feelings of those present were relieved by this little outburst of emotion. A pleasant evening followed, and except that the good nights exchanged on parting were tenderer, more heartfelt than usual, there were no indications that this was their last night together as a family circle. Darrell had been in his room but a short time, however, when he heard a light tap at his door, and, opening it, Mrs. Dean entered. "You seem like a son to me, Mr. Darrell," she said with quiet dignity, "so I have taken the liberty to come to your room for a few minutes the same as I would to a son's."
"That is right, Mrs. Dean," Darrell replied, escorting her to a large armchair. "My own mother could not be more welcome."
"You know us pretty well by this time, Mr. Darrell," she said, as she seated herself, "and you know that we're not given to expressing our feelings very much. But I felt that I couldn't let you go away without a few words with you first. I sometimes think that those who can't express themselves are the ones that feel the deepest, though I guess we often get the credit of not having any feelings at all."
"If I ever had such an impression of you or your brother, I found out my error long ago," Darrell remarked gravely as he paused.
"Yes, I think you understand us. I think you will understand me, Mr. Darrell, when I say to you that I haven't felt anything so deeply in years as I do your leaving us now. Not so much the mere fact of your going away as the real reason of your going. I felt bad when you left for camp a year ago, but this is altogether different. Then you felt, and we felt, that you were one of us, that your home was with us, and I hope that as long as you remained in the West, your home would be with us. Now, although there's no change in our love for you, or yours for us, I know that the place is no longer a home to you, that you do not care to stay, and about the hardest part of it all is that, knowing the circumstances as I do, I myself would not ask you to stay."
"You seem to understand the situation, Mrs. Dean. How did you learn the circumstances?" Darrell asked wonderingly.
She regarded him a moment with a motherly smile. "Did you think I was blind? I could see for myself. Catherine has told me nothing," she added in answer to the unspoken inquiry which she read in his eyes. "She has told me no more than you, but I saw what was coming long before either you or she realized it."
"Oh, Mrs. Dean, why didn't you warn me in time?" Darrell exclaimed.
"The time for warnings was when you two first met," Mrs. Dean replied. "For two as congenial to be thrown together so constantly would naturally result just as it has. It is no more than was to be expected, and neither of you can be blamed. And," she added slowly, "that is not the face of the affair which I most regret. I think such love as you two bear each other would work little harm or sorrow to either of you in the end, if matters could only be left to take their own course. I may as well tell you that I think no good will come of this scheme of David's. Mr. Walcott is not a suitable man for Catherine, even if she were heart-free, and loving you as she does, as she always will, for I understand the child, it would have been much better to have waited a year or two. I have no doubt that everything would come out all right. Of course, as I'm not her mother, I have no say in the matter and no right to interfere, but mark my words, David will regret this, and at no very distant day either."
"I know that nothing but unhappiness can come of it for Kate, and that is what troubles me far more than any sorrow of my own,"
said Darrell in a low voice. "It will bring unhappiness and evil all around, but to no one so much as David Underwood himself," said Mrs. Dean impressively as she rose.
"Mrs. Dean," said Darrell, springing quickly to his feet, "you don't know the good this little interview has done me. I thank you for it and for your sympathy from the bottom of my heart."
"I wish I could give you something more practical than sympathy," said Mrs. Dean, with a smile, "and I will if I ever have the opportunity. And one thing in particular I want to say to you, Mr. Darrell. So long as you are in the West, whether your home is with us or not, I want you to feel that you have a mother in me. And should you ever be sick or in trouble and need a mother's care and love, no matter where you are, I will come to you as I would to my own son."
They had reached the door. Darrell, too deeply moved for speech and knowing her aversion to many words, bent over her and kissed her on the forehead. "Thank you, mother. Good night," he said. She turned and looked at him with glistening eyes as she replied calmly,
"Good night, my son."
The household was astir at an early hour the next morning. There were forced smiles and some desultory conversation at the breakfast table, but it was a silent group which gathered outside in the early morning sunlight as Darrell was about taking his departure. He dreaded the parting, and as he glanced at the faces of the waiting group, he determined to make it as brief as possible for their sakes as well as his own. The heavy teams came slowly around from the stables, and behind them came Trix, daintily picking her steps along the driveway. With a word or two of instructions to the drivers, Darrell sent the teams ahead. Then, having adjusted saddle and bridle to his satisfaction, he turned to Mr. Underwood, who stood nearest.
"My boy," said the latter, extending his hand, "we hate to spare you from the old home, but I don't know where I would have got a man to take your place. With you up there, I feel just as safe as though I were there myself."
"Much obliged, Mr. Underwood," Darrell replied, looking straight into the elder man's eyes. "I think you'll find me worthy of any trust you may repose in me, at the camp or elsewhere."
"Every time, my boy, every time," exclaimed the old gentleman, wringing his hand.
Mrs. Dean's usually placid face was stern from her effort to repress her feelings, but there was a glance of mother-love in her eyes and a slight quivering of her lips as she bade him a quiet good-bye. But it was Kate's pale, sweet face that nearly broke his own composure as he turned to her last of all. Their hands clasped, and they looked silently into each other's eyes for an instant.
"Good-bye, John. God bless you," she said in tones audible only to his ear.
"God bless and help you, Katie," he replied, and turned quickly to Trix, waiting at his side.
"Look at Duke," said Kate a moment later, as Darrell sprang into the saddle. "He doesn't know what to make of it that you haven't bade him good-bye."
Duke, who had shown considerable excitement over the unusual proceedings, had bounded to Kate's side as Darrell approached her, expecting his usual recognition. Not having received it, he sat regarding Darrell with an evident sense of personal injury, quite pathetic. Darrell looked at the drooping head and smiled.
"Come, Duke," he said, slowly starting down the driveway.
Kate bent quickly for a final caress.
"Go on, Duke," she whispered.
Nothing loath to follow Darrell, he bounded forward, but after a few leaps, on discovering that his beloved mistress was not accompanying them, he stopped, looking back in great perplexity. At a signal from her and a word from Darrell, he again started onward, but his backward glances were more than Kate could bear, and she turned to go into the house.
"What are you sending the dog after him for, anyway?" inquired her father, himself somewhat puzzled.
"I have given Duke to Mr. Darrell, papa," she replied.
Something in the unnatural calmness of her tone startled him.
He turned to question her. She had gone, but in the glimpse which he had of her face he read a little of the anguish which at that moment wrung her young heart, and happening at the same time to catch his sister's eye, he walked away, silent and uncomfortable. End of chapter 19. Read by Lars Rolander.
Chapter 20 of At the Time Appointed. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Stephen Seidel. At the Time Appointed by A. Maynard Barber. Chapter 20. Forging the Fetters. During the weeks immediately following Darrell's departure, the daily routine of life at the Pines continued in the accustomed channels, but there was not a member of the family, including Mr. Underwood himself, to whom it did not seem strangely empty, as though some essential element were missing. To Kate, her present life, compared with the first months of her return home, was like the narrow current creeping sluggishly beneath the icy fetters of winter, as compared with the same stream laughing and singing on its way under summer skies. But she was learning the lesson that all must learn, that the world sweeps relentlessly onward with no pause for individual woe, and each must keep step in its ceaseless march, no matter how weary the brain or how heavy the heart. Walcott's visits continued with the same frequency, but he was less annoying in his attentions than formerly. It had gradually dawned upon him that Kate was no longer a child but a woman, and a woman with a will as indomitable as her father's once it was aroused. He was not displeased at the discovery. On the contrary, he looked forward with all the keener anticipation to the pleasure of what he mentally termed the taming process, once she was fairly within his power. Meantime, he was content to make a study of her, sitting evening after evening, either in conversation with her father or listening while she played and sang, but always watching her every movement, scanning every play of her features. "A loose rein for the present," he would say to himself with a smile, "but by and by, my lady, you will find out whether or no I am master." He seldom attempted now to draw her into a tete-a-tete conversation, but finding her one evening sitting upon a low divan in one of the bay windows looking out into the moonlight, he seated himself beside her and began one of his entertaining tales of travel. An hour or more passed pleasantly, and Walcott inquired, casually, "By the way, Miss Underwood, what has become of my four-footed friend? I have not seen him for 3 weeks or more, and his attentions to me were so marked I naturally missed them." "Duke is at the mining camp," Kate answered with a faint smile. Walcott raised his eyebrows incredulously. "Possible, with my other admirer, Mr. Darrell?" "He is with Mr. Darrell." "Accept my gratitude, Miss Underwood, for having made my entree into your home much pleasanter, not to say safer." "I neither claim nor accept your gratitude, Mr. Walcott," Kate replied with cool dignity, "since I did it simply out of regard for Duke's welfare and not out of any consideration whatever for your wishes in the matter." "I might have known as much," said Walcott, with a mock sigh of resignation, settling back comfortably among the pillows on the divan and fixing his eyes on Kate's face. "I might have known that any consideration for any wish of mine could never by any chance be assigned as a motive for an act of yours." Kate made no reply, but the lines about her mouth deepened. For a moment he watched her silently. Then he continued, slowly, in low, nonchalant tones, "I am positive that when I at last gain your consent to marry me," he paused an instant to note the effect of his words, but there was not the quiver of an eyelash on her part, Even then, you will have the audacity to tell me that you gave it for any other reason under heaven than consideration for me or my wishes." "Mr. Walcott," said Kate, facing him with sudden hauteur of tone and manner, "you are correct. If ever I consent to marry you, I can tell you now, as well as then, my reason for doing so. It will be simply and solely for my dear father's sake, for the love I bear him, out of consideration for his wishes, and with no more thought of you than if you did not exist." Conflicting emotions filled Walcott's breast at these words, but he preserved a calm, smiling exterior. He could not but admire Kate's spirit. At the same time, the thought flashed through his mind that this apparent slip of a girl might prove rather difficult to tame. But he reflected that the more difficult, the keener would be his enjoyment of the final victory. "A novel situation, surely," he commented, with a low musical laugh. "Decidedly unique." "But, my dear Miss Underwood," he continued a moment later, "if your love for your father and regard for his wishes are to constitute your sole reasons for consenting to become my wife, why need you withhold that consent longer? I am sure his wishes in the matter will remain unchanged, as will also your love for him. Why, then, should our marriage be further delayed? After what I have just told you, Mr. Walcott, do you still ask me to be your wife?" Kate demanded indignantly. "I do, Miss Underwood, and, pardon me, I feel that you have trifled with me long enough. I must have your answer." She rose, drawing herself proudly to her full height. "Take me to my father," she said imperiously. Walcott offered his arm, which she refused with a gesture of scorn, and they proceeded to the adjoining room where Mr. Underwood and his sister were seated together before the fire. As Kate advanced toward her father, both looked up simultaneously, and each read in her white face and proud bearing that a crisis was at hand. Mrs. Dean at once arose and noiselessly withdrew from the room. Walcott paused at a little distance from Mr. Underwood, assuming a graceful attitude as he leaned languidly over the large chair just vacated by Mrs. Dean. But Kate did not stop till she reached her father's side, where she bowed coldly to Walcott to proceed with what he had to say. "Some time ago, Mr. Underwood," he began, smoothly and easily, "I asked you for your daughter's hand in marriage, and you honored me with your consent. Since that time I have paid my addresses to Miss Underwood in so marked a manner as to leave no room for doubt or misunderstanding regarding my intentions, although, finding that she was not inclined to look upon me with favor, I have hitherto refrained from pressing my suit. Feeling now that I have given her an abundance of time, I have this evening asked her to become my wife and insisted that I was entitled to a decision. Instead, however, of giving me a direct answer, she has suggested that we refer the matter to yourself." "How is this, Kate?" her father asked, not unkindly. "I supposed you and I had settled this matter long ago." Her voice was clear, her tones unfaltering, as she replied, "Before giving my answer, I wanted to ask you, Papa, for the last time, whether, knowing the circumstances as you do and how I regard Mr. Walcott, it is still your wish that I marry him?" "It is, and I expect my child to be governed by my wishes in this matter rather than by her own feelings. Have I ever gone contrary to your wishes, Papa, or disobeyed you?" "No, my child, no." "Then I shall not attempt it at this late day. I only wanted to be sure that this was still your wish." "I desire it above all things," said Mr. Underwood, delighted to find Kate so ready to accede to his wishes, rising and taking her hand in his, "and the day that I see my little girl settled in the home which she will receive as a wedding gift from her old father will be the proudest and happiest day of my life." Kate smiled sadly. "No home can ever seem to me like the Pines, Papa. But I appreciate your kindness, and I want you to know that I am taking this step solely for your happiness." She then turned, facing Walcott, who advanced lightly, while Mr. Underwood made a movement as though to place her hand in his. "Not yet, papa," she said gently. Then, addressing Walcott, she continued, "Mr. Walcott, this must be my answer, since you insist on having one. Out of love for him who has been both father and mother to me, out of reverence for his gray hairs frosted by the sorrows of earlier years, out of regard for his wishes, which have always been my law, for his sake only, I consent to become your wife upon one condition." "Name it," Walcott replied. "There can be no love between us, either in our engagement or our marriage, for, as I have told you, I can never love you, and you yourself are incapable of love in its best sense. You have not even the slightest knowledge of what it is. For this reason, any token of love between us would be only a mockery, a farce, and true wedded love is something too holy, too sacred to be travestied in any such manner. I consent to our marriage, therefore, only upon this condition, that we henceforth treat each other simply with kindness and courtesy, that no expressions of affection or endearment are to be used by either one of us to the other, and that no word or sign of love ever pass between us."
"Kate," interposed her father sternly, "this is preposterous. I cannot allow such absurdity."
But Walcott silenced him with a deprecatory wave of his hand, and taking Kate's hand in his, replied with smiling indifference, "I accept the condition imposed by Miss Underwood, since it is no more unique than the entire situation, and I congratulate her upon her decided originality. I suppose," he added, addressing Kate, at the same time producing a superb diamond ring, "you will not object to wearing this?"
"I yield to that much conventionality," she replied, allowing him to place it on her finger. "There is no need to advertise the situation publicly. Besides, it is a fitting symbol of my future fetters."
"Conventionality, I believe, would require that it be placed on your hand with a kiss and some appropriate bit of sentiment. But since that sort of thing is tabooed between us, we will have to dispense with that part of the ceremony." Then, turning to Mr. Underwood, who stood looking on frowningly, somewhat troubled by the turn matters had taken, Walcott added playfully, "According to the usual custom, I believe the next thing on the program is for you to embrace us and give a father's blessing. But my lady might not approve of anything so commonplace." Before her father could reply, Kate spoke for him, glancing at him with an affectionate smile. "Papa is not one of the demonstrative sort, and he and I need no demonstration of our love for each other, do we, dear?"
"No, my child, we understand each other," said her father, reseating himself with Kate in her accustomed place on the arm of his chair, while Walcott took the large chair on the other side of the fire. "And you, neither of you, need any assurance of my good wishes or good intentions toward you. But," he continued, doubtfully shaking his head, "I don't quite like the way you've gone about this business, Puss."
"It was the only way for me, Papa," Kate answered, gravely and decidedly. "I admit," said Walcott, "it will be quite a departure from the mode of procedure ordinarily laid down for newly engaged and newly wedded couples. But really, come to think it over, I am inclined to think that Miss Underwood's proposition will save us an immense amount of boredom, which is the usual concomitant of engagements and honeymoons. That sort of thing, you know," he added, his lip curling just perceptibly, "is apt to get a little monotonous after a while." Kate, watching him from under level brows, saw the slight sneer and inwardly rejoiced at the stand she had taken. "Well," said Mr. Underwood resignedly, "fix it up between you any way to suit yourselves, but for heaven's sakes, don't do anything to cause comment or remarks." "Papa, you can depend on me not to make myself conspicuous in any way," Kate replied with dignity. "What I have said tonight was said simply to let you and Mr. Walcott know just where I stand, and just what you may and may not expect of me. But this is only between us three, and you can rest assured that I shall never wear my heart upon my sleeve or take the public into my confidence regarding my home life. I think myself you need have no fear on that score, Mr. Underwood, Walcott remarked with a smile of amusement. I believe Miss Underwood is entirely capable of carrying out to perfection any role she may assume. And if she chooses to take the part of leading lady in the little comedy of The Model Husband and Wife, I shall be only too delighted to render her any assistance within my power. As Walcott bade Kate good night at a late hour, he inquired, "What do you think of the little comedy I suggested tonight for our future line of action? Does it meet with your approval?" She was quick to catch the significance of the question, and, looking him straight in the eyes, she replied calmly, "It will answer as well as any, I suppose, but it has in it more of the elements of tragedy than of comedy." End of chapter 20.
Chapter 21 of At the Time Appointed. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording done by Jules Harlech of Mississauga, Ontario, Canada. At the Time Appointed by A. Maynard Barbour. Chapter 21. Two Crimes by the Same Hand. At Walcott's request, the date of the wedding was set early in January, he having announced that business would call him to the south the first week in December for about a month, and that he wished the wedding to take place immediately upon his return. The announcement of the engagement and speedily approaching marriage of the daughter of D.K. Underwood to his junior partner caused a ripple of excitement throughout the social circles of Ophir and Galilena. Though little known, Walcott was quite popular. It was therefore generally conceded that the shrewd mining king, as Mr. Underwood was denominated in that region, had selected a party in every way eligible as the future husband of the sole heiress of his fortune. Kate received the congratulations showered upon her with perfect equanimity, but with a shade of quiet reserve which effectually distanced all undue familiarity or curiosity. Through the daily paper which found its way to the mining camp, Darrell received his first news of Kate's engagement. It did not come as a surprise, however. He knew it was inevitable. He even drew a sigh of relief that the blow had fallen, for a burden is far more easily borne as an actual reality than by anticipation, and applied himself with an almost dogged persistency to his work. The winter set in early and with unusual severity. The snowfall in the mountains was heavier than had been known in years. Much of the time, the canyon road was impassable, making it impracticable for Darrell to visit the pines with any frequency, even had he wished to do so. The weeks passed, and ere he was aware, the holidays were at hand. By special messenger came a little note from Kate informing him of Walcott's absence and begging him to spend Christmas at the old home. There had been a lull of 2 or 3 days in the storm. The messenger reported the road somewhat broken, and early on the morning preceding Christmas, the trio, Darrell, Duke, and Trix, started forth, and after 12-hour siege, arrived at the pines wet, cold, and thoroughly exhausted, but all joyfully responsive to the welcome awaiting them. Christmas dawned bright and clear. Tokens of love and goodwill abounded on every side. But at an early hour news came over the wires, which shocked and saddened all who heard, particularly the household at The Pines. There had been a holdup on the westbound express the preceding night, a few miles from Galena, in which the mail and express had been robbed, and the express clerk, a brave young fellow who staunchly refused to open the safe or give the combination, had been fatally stabbed. It was said to be without doubt the work of the same band that had conducted the holdup in which Harry Whitcomb had lost his life, as it was characterized by the same boldness of plan and cleverness of execution. The affair brought back so vividly to Mr. Underwood and the family the details of Harry's death that it cast a shadow over the Christmas festivities, which seemed to deepen as the day wore on. Outside, too, gathering clouds, harbingers of coming storm, added to the general gloom. It was with a sense of relief that Darrell set out at an early hour the following morning for the camp. He realized as never before that the place teemed with painful memories whose very sweetness tortured his soul until he almost wished that the months since his coming to the Pines might be wrapped up in the same oblivion which veiled his life up to that period. He was glad to escape from its depressing influence and to return to the camp with its routine of work and study. The second winter of Darrell's life at camp was far more normal and helpful than the first. His love and sympathy for Kate had unconsciously drawn him out of himself, making him less mindful of his own sorrow and more susceptible to the suffering of others. To the men at the camp he was far different, interesting himself in their welfare in numerous ways where before he had ignored them. The unusual severity of the winter had caused some sickness among them, and it was nothing uncommon for Darrell to go off an evening to the miners' quarters with medicines, newspapers, and magazines for the sick and convalescents. He was returning from one of these expeditions late one evening, about 10 days after Christmas, accompanied by the collie. It had been snowing lightly and steadily all day, and the snow was still falling. Darrell was whistling softly to himself, and Duke, who showed a marvelous adaptation to Darrell's varying moods, catching the cue for his own conduct, began to plunge into the freshly fallen snow, wheeling and darting swiftly towards Darrell as though challenging him to a wrestling match. Darrell gratified his evident wish, and they tumbled promiscuously in the snow, emerging at length from the big drift near the office, their coats white, Duke barking with delight, Darrell laughing like a schoolboy. Shaking themselves, they entered the office, but no sooner had they stepped within than the collie bounded to the door of the next room, where he began a vigorous sniffing and scratching, accompanied by a series of short barks. As Darrell, somewhat puzzled by his actions, opened the door, he saw a figure seated by the fire, which rose and turned quickly, revealing to his astonished gaze the tall form and strong, sweet face of John Britton. For a moment the two men stood with clasped hands, looking into each other's eyes with a satisfaction too deep for words. After an affectionate scrutiny of his young friend, Mr. Britton resumed his seat, remarking, "You are looking well, better than I have ever seen you, and I'm glad to hear that laughter outside. It had the right ring to it." "Duke was responsible for that," Darrell answered, with a smiling glance at the collie, who had stationed himself by the fire and near Mr. Britton. "He challenged me to wrestle with him, and got rather the worst of it." A moment later, having divested himself of his great coat, he drew a second seat before the fire, saying, You evidently knew where to look for me. Yes, your last letter, which, by the way, followed me for nearly 6 weeks before reaching me, apprised me of your return to the camp. I was somewhat surprised, too, after you had established yourself so well in town. It was best for me and for others, Darrell answered. Then, noting the inquiry in his friend's eyes, he added, It is a long story, but it will keep. There will be plenty of time for that later. Tell me of yourself first. For 2 months I have hungered for word from you, and now I simply want to listen to you for a while. Mr. Britton smiled. I owe you an apology, but you know I am a poor correspondent at best, and of late business has called me here and there until I scarcely knew one day where I would be the next. Consequently, I have received my mail irregularly and have been irregular myself in writing. Darrell's face grew tender, for he knew it was not business alone which drove his friend from place to place, but the old pain which found relief only in ceaseless activity and an equally unceasing beneficence. He knew well that many of his friend's journeys were purely of a philanthropic nature, and he remarked with a peculiar smile, Your travels always remind me very forcibly of the journey of the Good Samaritan. When he met a case of suffering on the way, he was not the one to pass by on the other side, nor are you. Perhaps, said Mr. Britton gravely, he had found, as others have since, that pouring oil and wine into his neighbor's wounds was the surest method of assuaging the pain in some secret wound of his own. Darrell watched his friend closely while he gave a brief account of his recent journeys along the western coast. Never before had he seen the lines of suffering so marked upon the face beside him as that night. Something evidently had reopened the old wound, causing it to throb anew. I need not ask what has brought you back into the mountains at this time of year and in this storm, Darrell remarked, as his friend concluded. For answer, Mr. Britton drew from his pocket an envelope which Darrell at once recognized as a counterpart of one which had come to him some weeks before, but which he had laid away unopened, knowing only too well its contents. I'm particularly glad for Miss Underwood's sake that you are here, he said. She feared you might not come, and it worried her, which accounts for the importunate little note which accompanied the invitation, said Mr. Britton, with a half-smile, but I would have made it a point to be present in any event. Why did she doubt my coming? Because of the season, I suppose, and the unusual storms. Then, too, Darrell spoke with some hesitation, she told me she believed you had some sort of aversion to weddings. She was partly right, Mr. Britton said after a pause. I have not been present at a wedding ceremony for more than 25 years. Not since my own marriage, he added slowly in a low tone, as though making a confession. Darrell's heart throbbed painfully. It was the first allusion he had ever heard the other make to his own past, and from his tone and manner Darrell knew that he himself had unwittingly touched the great hidden sorrow of his friend's life. Forgive me, he said, with the humility and simplicity of a child. I have nothing to forgive, Mr. Britton replied gently, fixing his eyes with a look of peculiar affection upon Darrell's face. You know more now, my son, than the whole world knows or has known in all these years. And some day in the near future you shall know all, because, for some inexplicable reason, you, out of the whole world, seem nearest to me. A few moments later he resumed with more of his usual manner. I'm not quite myself tonight. The events of the last few days have rather upset me, and, with one of his rare smiles, I have come to you to get righted. "To me?" Darrell exclaimed. "Yes, why not? I am but your pupil, one who is beginning to look above his own selfish sorrows only through the lessons you have taught him. You overestimate the little I have tried to do for you, but were it even as you say, I would come to you and to no one else." "To whom did the divine master himself turn for human sympathy in his last hours of grief and suffering but to his little band of pupils, his disciples? And in proportion as they had learned of him and imbibed his spirit, in just that proportion could they enter into his feelings and minister to his soul." Mr. Britton had withdrawn the cards from the envelope and was regarding them thoughtfully. "The receipt of these bits of pasteboard," he said slowly, "unmanned me more than anything that has occurred in nearly a score of years. They called up long-forgotten scenes, little pathetic, heart-rending memories which I thought buried long ago. I don't mind confessing to you, my boy, that for a while I was unnerved. It did not seem as though I could ever bring myself to hear again the music of wedding bells and wedding marches, to listen to the old words of the marriage service. But for the sake of one who has seemed almost as my own child, I throttled those feelings and started for the mountains, resolved that no selfishness of mine should cloud her happiness on her wedding day. I came to find what I would never have believed possible, that my old friend would sacrifice his child's happiness, all that is sweetest and holiest in her life, to gratify his own ambition. I cannot tell you the shock it was to me. D.K. Underwood and I have been friends for many years, but that did not prevent my talking plainly with him, so plainly that perhaps our friendship may never be the same again. But it was of no avail, and the worst is, he has persuaded himself that he is acting for her good, when it is simply for the gratification of his own pride." I could not stay there. The very atmosphere seemed oppressive, so I came up here for a day or two, as I told you, to get righted. "And you came to me to be righted," Darrell said musingly. "Can the blind lead the blind?" Mr. Britton was quick to catch the significance of the other's query. "Yes, John," he answered, covering Darrell's hand with his own. "I came to you for the very reason that your hurt is far deeper than mine." Under the magnetism of that tone and touch, Darrell calmly and in few words told his story and Kate's, the story of their love and brief happiness, and of the wretchedness which followed. "For a while I constantly reproached myself for having spoken to her of love," he said in conclusion, "for having awakened her love, as I thought, by my own. But gradually I came to see that she had loved me as I had her, unconsciously, almost from our first meeting, and that the awakening must in any event have come sooner or later to each of us. Then it seemed as though my suffering all converged in sorrow for her, that her life, instead of being gladdened by love, should be saddened and marred, perhaps wrecked by it. Love works strange havoc with human lives sometimes," Mr. Britton remarked reflectively as Darrell paused. "I was tempted at times," Darrell continued, "as I thought of what was in store for her, to rescue her at any cost, tempted to take her and go with her to the ends of the earth, if necessary, anywhere, to save her from the life she dreads." "Thank God that you did not, my son," Mr. Britton exclaimed, strangely agitated by Darrell's words. "You do not know what the cost might have been in the end, what bitter remorse, what agony of ceaseless regret." He stopped abruptly, and again Darrell felt that he had looked for an instant into those depths so sacredly guarded from the eyes of the world. "You did well to leave as you did," Mr. Britton said, after a moment's silence. in which he had regained his composure. "I had to. I should have done something desperate if I had remained there much longer." Darrell spoke quietly, but it was the quiet of suppressed passion. "It was better so, better for you both," Mr. Britton continued. "When we find ourselves powerless to save our loved ones from impending trouble, all that is left us is to help them bear that trouble as best we may. The best help you can give Kate now is to take yourself as completely as possible out of her life. How you can best help her, later time alone will show." A long silence followed while both watched the flickering flames and listened to the crooning of the wind outside. When at length they spoke, it was on topics of general interest. The outlook at the mining camp, the latest news in the town below, till their talk at last drifted to the recent holdup. "A dastardly piece of work," exclaimed Mr. Britton. "The death of that young express clerk was in some ways even sadder than that of Harry Whitcomb. I knew him well, the only child of a widowed mother, a poor boy who, by indomitable energy and unswerving integrity, had just succeeded in securing the position which cost him his life. To such brutal, cowardly murders ought to arouse the people to such systematic, concerted action as would result in the final arrest and conviction of the murderer. It is the general opinion that both were committed by one and the same party," Darrell remarked as his friend paused. "Undoubtedly, both were the work of the same hand, in all probability that of the leader himself. He is a man capable of any crime, probably guilty of nearly every crime that could be mentioned, and his men are mere tools in his hands. He exerts a strange power over them, and they obey him, knowing that their lives would pay the forfeit for disobedience. Human life is nothing to him, and anyone who stood in the way of the accomplishment of his purposes would simply go the way those two poor fellows have gone." "Why, do you know anything regarding this man?" Darrell asked in surprise. "Only so far as I have made a study of him and his methods, aided by whatever information I could gather from time to time concerning him." "Surely you're not a detective," Darrell exclaimed. "You spoke like one just now." "Not professionally," his friend answered with a smile, "though I have often assisted in running down criminals. I have enough of the hound nature about me, however, that when a scent is given me, I delight in following the trail till I run my game to cover, as I hope some day to run this man to cover," he added with peculiar earnestness. "But how did you ever gain so much knowledge of him? To everyone else he seems an utter mystery." "Partly, as I said, through a study of him and his methods, and partly from facts which I learned from one of the band who was fatally shot a few years ago in a skirmish between the brigands and a posse of officials. The man was deserted by his associates and was brought to town and placed in a hospital. I did what I could to make the poor fellow comfortable, with the result that he became quite communicative with me, and, while in no way betraying his confederates, he gave me much interesting information regarding the band and its leader. It is a thoroughly organized body of men bound together by the most fearful oaths, possessing a perfect system of signals and passwords, and with a retreat in the mountains known as the Pocket, so inaccessible to any but themselves that no one as yet has been able to definitely locate it, a sort of basin walled about by perpendicular rocks. The leader is a man of mixed blood, who has traveled in all countries and knows many dark secrets, and whose power lies mainly in the mystery with which he surrounds himself. No one knows who he is, but many of his men believe him to be the very devil personified. But how can you or anyone else hope to run down a man with such powerful followers and with a hiding place so inaccessible? Darrell inquired. From a remark inadvertently dropped, I was led to infer that this man spends comparatively little time with the band. He communicates with them, directs them, and personally conducts any especially bold or difficult venture, but most of the time he is amid far different surroundings, leading an altogether different life. One of those men with double lives, Darrell commented. Mr. Britton bowed in assent. But if that were so, Darrell persisted, his interest thoroughly aroused, as much by Mr. Britton's manner as by his words. In the event, say, of your meeting him, how would you be able to recognize or identify him? Have you any clue to his identity? Years ago, said Mr. Britton slowly, I formed the habit of studying people. At first as I met them, later as I heard or read of them. Facts gathered here and there concerning a person's life I put together, piece by piece, studying his actions and the probable motives governing those actions, until I had a mental picture of the real man, the ego that constitutes the foundation of the character of every individual. Having that fixed in my mind, I next strove to form an idea of the exterior which that particular ego would gradually build about himself through his habits of thought and speech and action. In this way, by a careful study of the man's life, I can form something of an idea of his appearance. I have often put this to the test by visiting various penitentiaries in order to meet some of the noted criminals of whose careers I had made a study, and invariably in expression, in voice and manner, in gait and bearing, in the 101 little indices by which the soul betrays itself, I have found them as I had mentally portrayed them. Mr. Britton had risen while speaking and was walking back and forth before the fire. I see, Darrell exclaimed, and you have formed a mental portrait of this man by which you expect to recognize and identify him. I am satisfied that I would have no difficulty in recognizing him, Mr. Britton replied, with peculiar emphasis on the last words, the work of identification. He paused in front of Darrell, looking him earnestly in the face. That, I hope, will one day be yours. Mine? Exclaimed Darrell. How so? I do not understand. Mr. Underwood has told me that soon after your arrival at the Pines, and just before you became delirious, there was something on your mind in connection with the robbery and Whitcomb's death, which you wished to tell him but were unable to recall. And both he and his sister have said that often during your delirium you would mutter, "That face, I can never forget it. It will haunt me as long as I live." It has always been my belief that amidst the horrors of the scene you witnessed that night, you in some way got sight of the murderer's face, which impressed you so strongly that it haunted you even in your delirium. It is my hope that with the return of memory, there will come a vision of that face sufficiently clear that you will be able to identify it should you meet it, as I believe you will. Darrell scrutinized his friend closely before replying, noting his evident agitation. "You have already met this man and recognized him," he exclaimed. "Possibly," was the only reply. End of chapter 21.
Zaxby's Sensation Salad is so much more than a plain old salad. It's a salad, which begs the question, at what point does a salad stop being a salad and become a salad? Is it when you add Zaxby's fried chicken to it? Crunchy wontons? Asian slaw? Citrus vinaigrette? Teriyaki glaze? Sweet and spicy sauce? Or is it when you top it all with a handmade perfectly fried egg roll? Without a doubt, the egg roll. The Zenzation Salad, only at Zaxby's.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.